From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Disney and Comcast continue their bidding war for some of the Fox assets. In the end, it'll be largely up to this guy.
I'm Rupert Murdoch, the billionaire tyrant.
Then actor Edward James Olmos explains why the film festival that he founded is back after a five-year hiatus.
The Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival is the largest Latino international film festival in the world. And when we stopped it, oh, man, people were in shock. And it was hard.
And a new documentary tells how 50 female filmmakers broke into the business. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's Jane, a documentary by Brett Morgan profiling conservationist Jane Goodall using more than 100 hours of lost archival footage. Emmy-eligible in all categories. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll start today's show with this.
Well, I guess it's impossible to control all the media. Unless, of course, you're Rupert Murdoch. He is one beautiful man.
I couldn't agree more.
No, those are not the CEOs of Disney and Comcast trying to curry favor with Rupert Murdoch, but the sentiments of those characters from The Simpsons perhaps aren't far from what Disney's Bob Iger and Brian Roberts at Comcast are feeling as they try to outbid each other for some of the Fox company assets. Today, Disney significantly increased its bid for Fox's production arm, cable channels, and other properties, and Rupert Murdoch seems to like the offer. But Comcast is expected to counteroffer soon, as both companies try to beef up their portfolios in an ever-changing media landscape. In the end, Murdoch will still control the Fox Broadcast Network, the Fox News Channel, and Fox Sports, so he will remain a force to be reckoned with. Keech Hagee is a Wall Street Journal reporter covering the story, and when we spoke, I asked how much longer the bidding war over Fox would continue.
Well, I thought it was very telling this morning that Fox chose to indefinitely postpone its shareholder meeting when everyone would decide which bid to take. So that suggests to me that they're expecting a long, hot summer of a bidding war.
Why are the Fox assets so attractive to either Disney or Comcast? How do they complete or build the established companies?
Well, you know, the Fox Movie Studio is one of the great studios. They have some really incredible intellectual property, like The Simpsons and Avatar. And there is an opinion that Disney has been really the master at monetizing these kind of characters and bits of intellectual property. They kind of have shown the entire media industry how to do it. And if they could get their hands on some of Fox's characters and bits of intellectual property, they would make a lot more money from them.
Right. Even though Disney already owns Marvel Studios, there's some Marvel characters that Disney doesn't own. And Fox has the X-Men and Wolverine and Deadpool. Is that part of the equation as well, that they can grow the Marvel brand within Disney?
Sure. I've heard people talk about that. Disney, as I said, has shown people how it's done. And there's a sense that there's really just more overall value if you stuck that stuff into the Disney machine.
And one other thing that's a factor, too, is Hulu. A lot of people think of Netflix when it comes to streaming, but Hulu seems to be a big part of the equation. Why is Hulu and Fox's ownership in Hulu attractive?
Fox has really been, just from my observation, the leader in Hulu. I mean, yeah, it's owned by multiple owners, right? We have NBC, ABC, Fox, and now Time Warner are all owners. But for Fox, it has been really central to their strategy of new forms of advertising and a way of basically creating a bulwark for the industry, for the traditional industry, against Netflix. So it's a place where you can sell your content and kind of use to bid against Netflix, right? If you have a studio, that's a useful thing. And, you know, I think there are a lot of forces within Fox that saw Hulu as something that could be a major competitor to Netflix if they could just really get the engines of investment behind it.
And why does Rupert Murdoch feel that this is a good time to be selling these Fox assets?
It's been a rough couple of years in media. And, you know, he has said that there are major players out there, tech players, namely, there's the Googles and the Facebooks of the world that are now sucking up ever larger bits of online advertising. And there's a general sense that you need to be bigger to compete. The entire industry is consolidating, and we've seen people cutting the cord. It's really hurt media stocks over the last few years. And so there's a feeling that maybe it's better to put all our eggs in one basket and put technological investment behind that and see if we can go head-to-head with some of these big guys.
The Fox Network and Fox News are not part of this deal, but there's been a lot of talk in the last couple of days about Fox News and how it's affected people who are making content for Fox. Is that potentially complicate any part of this deal?
Long term, maybe. I mean, yeah, sure. It's a very loud discussion in the press, but that's not something that I've heard people who are making the decisions are thinking about.
Through ESPN, Disney already has a huge sports presence. What would Fox's regional sports channels add for either Disney or Comcast?
In the individual markets, those are really powerful. Although, I think in some ways you could say what they would add might be regulatory headaches. They've said that they are willing to divest them in markets where it would be a problem. But the regional sports networks are kind of must-carry channels in the markets where they are, and they help the distributors a lot, so they can help the overall bundle of channels get higher rates.
Some of these offers are cash. Some of these offers are cash and stock. Does that really mean anything different for anybody involved?
It does. It particularly means something to the Murdoch family, which has owned the Fox assets for a long time, for decades. And so their basis in the stock is very low, maybe zero. And so if they sold it for cash, they would have to pay an enormous capital gains. Whereas if they simply exchanged it for stock, they wouldn't have to pay taxes. So, I was speaking to an independent tax analyst yesterday who said, this was before the Disney sweetened bid, that just from a tax perspective, the Disney all-stock deal, which was lower back then, would be a better deal for the Murdochs just because of the taxes and the structure of the cash versus stock deal.
But it may not be the same for all shareholders.
Oh, that's completely right. So the biggest shareholders in Fox are mostly these institutional investors, and they don't really care about taxes. They're structured in a way they just pass the tax burden on to their investors in a lot of cases. So there is a bit of divergence of incentives within the Fox shareholder structure.
And finally, we're at $71 billion. How much higher could this go? What's going to happen next, even if you're just kind of guessing in terms of where the bidding is going to go?
Well, it does seem like Comcast is putting together another bid pretty soon. That's the chatter that we're hearing. So I would expect this would not be the end, and we'll see another bid from Comcast.
Keech Hagee is a Wall Street Journal reporter. Keech, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the L.A. Latino International Film Festival is returning. Co-founder Edward James Olmos tells me why it went away and why it's coming back.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's series One Strange Rock, hosted by Will Smith and executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia. An elite ensemble of astronauts tells the unexpected and unprecedented story of Earth, filmed across 900,000 plus miles, 45 countries, 6 continents, and outer space. Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider. Explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and now the LA Latino International Film Festival, or LALIF, kicks off tonight at the TCL Chinese Theater in Hollywood. From 1998 to 2013, the festival brought films by Latino filmmakers from all over the world to Los Angeles, but then it went away. Now, after a five-year hiatus, LaLeaf is back, and it's not all about the films this time. I spoke with LaLeaf's executive director, Rafael Augustin, and one of its original co-founders, actor Edward James Olmos, about why the festival is being revived. And I began by asking Olmos how LaLeaf got created in the first place.
We started this back in 1998, trying to bring about an understanding of the work, the Latino work that was happening all over the world that we never get to see. So that was the whole intention, was to bring cinema, Iberoamerica cinema, right here to Los Angeles and to the United States. And over the years, we've been able to grow into a very strong international film festival.
I should say, too, that you guys did some amazing work. You were showing films from Guillermo del Toro, Alfonso Cuarón, Alejandro Iñárritu, Pablo Lorraine. You were really highlighting filmmakers that today we know about, but back then maybe weren't as well known.
Well, they weren't known, not in 1998. They were the first ones that we brought. Cuarón, Iñárritu, and del Toro were the three directors that we brought from Mexico. And this was in 1998. We introduced them to Warner Brothers, to Paramount, to Disney, to Universal, to 20th, all the major studios. We took them around, and as we do to all of our filmmakers as we bring them into the United States. And it was amazing. And, of course, we have young, great filmmakers here in the United States that we also premiered, and we give access to all of the studios also.
Rafael, if I had visited the festival back then, what would you have been doing? Were you selling popcorn? What was your job?
I started off as a volunteer during the youth program, Moving Tables and Chairs. And this was a screen education program that brought public school students into the festival to teach them the art of filmmaking. The beauty of it all is that now we've come full circle, because out of the youth program was born the Youth Cinema Project, which is a statewide project-based learning program that teaches filmmaking to what used to be dubbed at-risk students, but we can call them emerging students. So we work with elementary school students, middle school students, and high school students. And the work that we're having in the classroom is doubling reading and writing proficiency, tripling school engagement, creating social emotional empowerment. And this year, according to our data, we realized that we're having great impact in English language redesignation. So all that through the art of filmmaking.
Why did the festival go away, and what brought it back?
Exactly that. It's the Youth Cinema Project. 5 years ago, we decided to focus all of our attention on our youth. When we think about Oscars So White, the answer to that is not changing voting regulations. And I say that with all due respect, because Mr. Olmos is a member of the Academy. The answer to Oscars So White is developing our communities of color at an early age, which is exactly what we're doing.
So go ahead, Eddie.
It was an amazing 20 years of getting it to this level. In the last 5 years, we've literally pushed it through to a point that it's now become probably the most advanced teaching method in California, if not in the United States.
And what are good outcomes for that? And how do they overlap with what you're trying to do with the festival? How do they mesh in terms of results?
Well, basically, we're a film festival. So I think this year we've made 128 films. We made 128 films starting in the fourth grade, fifth grade, all the way up to 12th grade. They say we're at risk, but really we're just in schools. What has happened is the principals get us into their schools, and then they put us with where they need us the most. And usually it's with people that are, you know, English deficient, or they, you know, have problems. And so we find ourselves being able to go into those classrooms. And John, it's beyond your wildest understanding. I cannot tell you what happens to people's self-esteem, self-respect, and self-worth when you allow them to be creative. You know, when you collaborate with somebody, when you communicate, when you use your critical thinking, when you use creativity, you're way, way ahead of the game. And when you use that in the fourth grade and you get exposed to it, you'll use it for the rest of your life. I can't even begin to tell you how closely knit the festival is to exactly what we're talking about right now.
Rafael, it sounds like what Youth Cinema Project is doing is not only filling a void in arts education and doing something for the community, it's also developing the next generation of filmmakers and actors. Stacey Smith and her team at USC looked at the 100 highest grossing films from 2016. 54 of those films, more than half, did not have a single Latino-speaking character. So when you're thinking about the role that the Youth Cinema Project can play and the festival can play, how important is it that you are developing and promoting and highlighting the work of the next generation of storytellers?
Mr. Ramos told me in full confidence that when he leaves this world, which won't happen for a very long time, we have 20 more years of La Leaf ahead of us, when he does finally leave this world, he believes that he won't be remembered for his film work or for all the awards that he does, that his legacy on Earth is the Youth Cinema Project. And out of this conversation, we built out La Leaf Legacy, which is our very first student film festival within La Leaf. This will be free and open to the public Saturday and Sunday, and there's nothing, I believe, more powerful than having students from all over the state of California. We work with 1,400 students throughout the state right now, and they're all going to be gathered at one place, networking with each other and with professional filmmakers, international and U.S. Latino filmmakers.
And who do you hope to see at the festival? What is your best hope for what the audience looks like, the people who are coming to check out the films?
John, this is open. I mean, it's as open as when you go down to, you know, Arclight or into Edwards Theaters or wherever you walk in there, you're going to find a whole bunch of people from all mixes, cultures, and everything there. And that's what's going to happen. And that's what has happened. You got to remember that the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival is the largest Latino international film festival in the world. And when we stopped it, people were in shock. And it was hard, because we had to focus, and we focused. And now we have, inside of the Latino Film Festival, an entire culture that has materialized that are young, I mean, really young. I mean, fourth grade is 9 years old. You know, from 9 years old up, walking in there. When we take our 9 years old to Pixar, okay, because they don't let anyone into Pixar, but they let the Youth Cinema Project into Pixar. And when they go into Pixar and they're talking with the animators and they're talking to the, what happens is that the questions that those kids ask those artists is monumental, because they're all like equal and they're all very confident and they're all looking right into the eyes of the artists that they're relating to, the masters, the people who are the professionals. And it changes the whole perspective of a human being, man. You cannot make emphasis enough on what happens when self-esteem, self-respect, and self-worth are put into a child's understanding at a very young age.
And the thing I would add, Rafael, is that it's incredibly important for young people to see a version of themselves in front of them. It could be an actor, it could be a director, it could be, you know, a producer. And yet we're still at a place where, even though Latinos are a huge part of the movie-going audience, they don't typically get represented. Coco was a huge hit, but it was kind of an outlier. Jane the Virgin is a huge hit, but was not an easy show to get made. So what is the next chapter in that story, and how does the equation change so that people of color, women, people from the LGBTQ community are not outliers, but are represented just as people, not as types?
I do believe, in all of my years seeing our artists from our community through La Leaf, I've noticed that we have some of the world's best actors, directors, cinematographers. But as far as US Latinos, what we've been lacking is storytellers. And no one truly is developing these storytellers. That's why we decided to focus our attention on the Youth Cinema Project. It has become the heart and foundation of everything that La Leaf stands for. And I think in TV, where our storytellers are having the greatest success, we are now seeing complicated, great Latinx stories being told, because we finally got Latinas in positions of power, such as Gloria Calderon Kellett with One Day at a Time, with Tania Saracho, with Vida, and we hope to continue that trend. Our community is not advancing in film as fast as we should because of access and opportunity. That is why when we discussed bringing back La Leaf, we wanted to make sure we were embracing everywhere that we were advancing, such as art, such as music, such as podcasts. That's why we decided to build out pillars of La Leaf, such as La Leaf Music, La Leaf Art, La Leaf Legacy. And we're going to continue to do that moving forward.
We should make sure that we're going to give props to what you're doing going ahead. Eddie, you have a movie. Is it The Devil Has a Name or El Diablo Tiene un Nombre? What is the name of
The Devil Has a Name. It's a very interesting film. Quirky to the point of where people, I think, will find it at times very funny and other times very much understanding of the truth that it brings about, because it's a true story. This is dealing with the water contamination in the Central Valley as we speak and are going through this right now. That's the theme of the story. And I got to tell you, it's pretty intense. It's pretty powerful.
And Raphael, you're working on Jane the Virgin as a writer, but you're also developing something called Illegal. Tell me about that show.
That is actually based on my life as a former undocumented student that I recently sold to CBS Studios with Gina Rodriguez as my executive producer. And to bring this full circle, Gina and I actually met at La Leaf.
So show up and you might run into Gina Rodriguez and good things will happen.
Absolutely.
Edward James Olmos is the co-founder of La Leaf. Rafael Augustin is the executive director. Eddie and Rafael, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, John.
Gracias.
La Leaf begins tonight and runs through Sunday at the TCL Chinese Theater in Hollywood. Coming up, a new documentary examines why there are so few women directors working today.
KPCC supporters include HBO, presenting Westworld. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. This dark odyssey follows the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmers' carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
And now, allegations of sexual misconduct have in many ways changed the way that we look at Hollywood. The Me Too movement has relied on women standing up to tell their stories, often at great personal and professional risk. The movement also shows how patriarchal show business has been, where sexual harassment and worse is not only carried out, but also tolerated, excused, or covered up. But a new documentary takes an empowering view of women in filmmaking today. Director Amy Adrian's Half the Picture features interviews with nearly 50 female filmmakers, including Catherine Hardwicke and Ava DuVernay. It debuted at Sundance earlier this year, and it opens in theaters on June 22nd. When I spoke with Adrian, it was back when Sundance had announced that it would debut her film, and we began with the challenges that she faced getting so many prominent filmmakers to be in her first feature documentary.
You know, one of the first women I reached out to was Catherine Hardwicke, and immediately she got back to me and she said, yes, I'm in, I'm doing it. It's not because of me that she wanted to do it. It's because she is so on the front lines of this issue and so committed to this issue. So she was kind of one of the first interviews we did. And then I had worked with Miranda July. You get Miranda July, and then you get, you know, Karin Kusama and Mary Harron, and it becomes easier to convince people to do it. But I was actually very pleasantly surprised that there wasn't that much convincing that I needed to do.
Your film is about to debut at a very complicated time for women in all aspects of culture and business, not just in Hollywood, but in the news media, in politics. I'm wondering if you think that the arrival of your film, given what's happening in the nation with all of these stories of sexual harassment and assault, gives it a topicality that maybe you could never have imagined.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like when we first started making this film, I still would get questions. I was at an event with a female producer who was asking me about the film and about the women we interviewed. And she said, well, you know, why do they say there are so few women directors? And, you know, I feel like that's a question that, you know, people may still ask at this point, but it's not like hard to comprehend how it's so difficult for women to reach the highest levels of this business. I mean, you see the really egregious and powerful forces that are working against them. And it's kind of astonishing that every day there's more information that comes out and more women are standing up and talking about their experiences at great personal expense. My head is spinning. It's such an incredible time, and we certainly never could have predicted it when we began making the film.
Well, one of the things where it is actually an issue is that in the beginning of your film, you have interviews with Jeffrey Tambor and John Lasseter. So how are you going to try to deal with those interviews?
We have had to recut parts of our film almost day by day, given some of the information that's come out. We had a woman director talking about Harvey Weinstein, and we had to edit that out of the film because it was just too jarring. I mean, she wasn't mentioning it in the context of sexual harassment or sexual assault, early in the film. We also had a segment with Charlie Rose that is now not in the film, just because I feel like viewers' minds go to that place. And this is a film that certainly explores the challenges that women directors face. And in some small part of the film talks about sexual harassment. But this is not a film about the bad behavior of men. This is a film about the strength of women.
So we know statistically that women face an incredibly difficult time getting jobs behind the camera, and that they don't get a lot of money to make their films. And if, God forbid, their film doesn't work, they end up in director's jail for far longer than their male counterparts. We know those statistics and those stories are true. Did you start to get some insight into why they are true, why that happens? What is it about the culture of Hollywood that not only permits that, but in some ways also encourages it?
Well, certainly there's unconscious bias about who many of us think of when we think of a director. And usually it is a white guy in a baseball hat. And, you know, you see someone like Dee Reese, who's incredibly talented, and you have to mentally go like, you need to make an adjustment to be like, yeah, of course that's a director. And I think there's the whole like male genius myth where you can act completely insane and berate people and throw things. And if you're passionate and if the movies are good, it's you're just a genius. And, you know, everyone accepts it because of what a genius that person is. And women don't have a counterpart to that. There's not a, you know, a female version of that. And the women in the film who we interviewed, who are experts on these issues, like Caroline Labresco at Sundance and Stacey Smith at USC and Dr. Martha Lawson at San Diego State University, women tend not to be in these networks of influence as much. At the agencies and production companies and networks, they're still largely run by men, and men run in those networks and just have more access to these opportunities.
As you're interviewing these directors, you also show your side of the interview, and it often shows that there are mainly women behind your cameras. Was that important to you, that a film about female directors be made by female filmmakers?
Absolutely. With this film, it was certainly was important for me to work with a largely female crew, to give women who I know are so talented, who haven't had the opportunities they deserve, to get some of those opportunities. And also, sitting in these interviews, they were just like a masterclass with each of these directors. And every woman who was in that room left the room just kind of spinning, inspired, like ready to take on the world. And I felt like if I can give women the opportunity to be sitting in this room with Ava DuVernay and Jill Soloway and Lena Dunham and Tina Mabry and all these incredible women telling their stories, you know, that was important as well.
Amy Adrian is the director and producer of the documentary Half the Picture. Amy, thanks so much for coming in.
This was a thrill. Thank you so much for having me.
And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.